science, learning, business, community. You. Welcome to Think Works, the podcast for people who like to think. Because thinking is the hardest work there is. Come with us on a journey into the world of ideas with your host, Darren Smithson.
Hello, welcome to ThinkWorks, a place where we do all the heavy lifting when it comes to thinking. And this week we're going to talk about the comics giant that never was. And that's Atlas Comics, that were launched 50 years ago this year and had visions of taking on the big two, DC and Marvel. And in fact, they launched as the new House of Ideas, a definite kind of jab at Marvel Comics, who were just across the road from them in their headquarters that they set up. We'll tell the full story. I just wanted to do a quick introduction to say Chris and I did this over a Zoom call, and therefore there isn't a formal introduction as such. We just get straight into the chat. I hope you enjoy it. I'll come back at the end to tag on a little bit, and then we'll explain what's going on and everything. So here we are, without further ado, Atlas Comics, the comics giant that never was. So I'd like to welcome Chris Dingsdale to the conversation about Atlas Comics. And we've known each other for ages now.
Long time. Yeah.
And that was, I think that was through Samara and Lucky Target Comics.
It would have been, yeah. We suffered the scars of comic conventions as retailers.
We did. And
many scars.
Yes, and if you live in the UK, you know exactly what we're talking about, because comic cons over here tend to be, in particular, very trying for the exhibitors, shall we say?
Yeah.
Right, so we're here to talk about Atlas Comics because originally we were going to do this kind of Adventures in Comics and just talk about our nerdiness and our love of all things comic-dom. But we realised that it's 50 years this year since Atlas Comics actually launched. And we thought, do you know what? It's not going to be very polite if we don't acknowledge the fact that after 50 years, everyone is still talking about a comic company that only lasted about 10 months.
So it was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun. And I think people forget that sometimes, that comics are meant to be fun. And, well, we'll get into all the nitty-gritty about why they failed and all that kind of funky stuff, and why, despite all the chaos that seemed to be around them, they were fun. So let's talk about Atlas themselves and where they came from and how they arose. Okay. So what's your recollection of it all?
My personal recollection was, I mean, I grew up in a town outside Liverpool, and 1975, so I was into the beginnings of comic collecting. So I pretty much had a flight path around the town of Runcorn, the old town, I should say. And one Saturday when I was on my bike going, trying to collect as many titles as I could afford, there was one newsagent's, and these new titles appeared in the spinner rack.
Yeah.
At first, I thought it was, oh, it's Neil Adams on Conan, because I knew it.
Yeah.
And I looked closely. No, it's not Conan. It's something called Iron Jaw.
Yes.
The trade dress, I suppose we should say, was extremely similar to Marvel Comics.
Yes.
So I bought a couple. So that was the introduction. I, at the time, obviously, this is pre-internet, pre-any information, really, sort of solicitation information. I didn't know where they'd come from, but, you know, these were new titles. And, of course, you know, we were all on the lookout for a number one.
We were. I guess
we thought we were going to finance our, you know, financial futures through them.
Yeah, our university trip will be financed by our college,
And, you know, and flashcards, et cetera. Yeah. But wasn't to be, but there we go. So that was my intro. What about you?
It's pretty similar, actually. I mean, I think we should just mention, in the UK at the time, American comics themselves were really hard to get hold of. Some DC titles sporadically appeared here and there. Charlton, I think, were around. But Marvel Color Comics in particular weren't.
And because we had Marvel UK, of course, doing all the black and white reprints. So we had that, and then, as you say, so I was a news agent. We'd gone down to the local news agent at Dartmouth with my cousin, me and my cousin Stephen, and I was buying comics. I was quite an avid comic reader, and we went into this news agent, and I can't remember if I'd gone in for my weeklies or not, but I'd gone in. We'd gone into this news agent, and as you say, on the spinner rack, suddenly there are these really colourful, garish in some respects, covers staring at us. And we went, oh, what are these? And we just thought, okay, well, let's give them a try. I think he bought five and I bought five or six. And then we got back to his place and we read the five that we bought each, and then we swapped and then read the five. And we were just blown away. And you know, and looking back, when you look at them now, it was so. They were so, some of them were really badly written, let's be honest.
Really badly written, yeah.
But there was just something about them. They had this kind of verve, didn't they? That everything about them said, we are going to be great fun. And I mean, I couldn't really compare them to American Marvel comics at the time because I didn't have any. I think the first two issues I bought from Marvel the US were Amazing Tales 28, which was Kilraven, and Astonishing Tales 28, which was Deathlok. So that's about the same time, but that's all I could really compare them to. But they just blew me away. And then for the next, what, 6 months, I think it was, 6 months or so,
Maybe not even 6 months,
yeah,
I
we
mean, I
did
think the
the,
other advantage of them, Darren, was you didn't need any background to this.
no.
You were aware if you picked a Marvel Color comic up of the ones that came across, that there was this huge history behind it and that, huge amount of continuity that you weren't party of until the reprints would actually catch up. With the Atlas ones, they were starting from number one, you're in on the ground floor.
Straight new universe, straight in. And
Completely.
I think that was part of the fun because we instinctively, we didn't, it wasn't kind of like a conscious, oh, yes, we're now in this fantastic new universe. But I think there was this instinct that said, this is brand new and we're in at the start and this could be really exciting. I think that was there. It just wasn't a conscious nugget of thought. I mean, I'd be 10, 10 and a half when these comics
I think
hit.
I'd be 11 going on 12, so
Yeah.
whatever.
So, and I think the first titles I got were Hands of the Dragon 1, Cougar 2. I got Cougar 2 before Cougar 1. Wolf, Fright with Son of Dracula, which I really
Oh yeah,
loved.
Frank Thorne artwork, yeah.
And some, and I can't remember what the other two were. I think it might have been The Destructor, with Steve Ditko, of course. And I can't remember what the other one was, but it'll come to me. But basically, I picked these five or six titles up, and then, as I say, he got another five or six titles that were different from mine, and we just swapped. And then, as quickly as they arrived, they vanished. It was just like,
Absolutely. Completely. I mean, they just disappeared again. And obviously we didn't know the history behind them or
no.
anything like that. So it's interesting to catch up on that now. I mean, my big favorite was The Scorpion by Chaykin, which I just thought was
Yes.
totally wonderful. And we'll come to this again, but there was a future for that title.
Yes,
Beyond Atlas,
absolutely.
thankfully. But I love that because I discovered O'Neill and Klute as The Shadow earlier that year, and also the Doc Savage novels and the Doc Savage Black and White from Marvel. So that was really, I really love that title. Well, until it took a left turn, like they all took a left turn
About
somewhere.
2 months in.
About 2 or 3 months in.
Right,
But I
so
mean, what was the longest li lived title? Was it like four issues? Destructor,
four.
maybe?
Yeah, the
Iron Joe?
Destructor got to four. Iron Joe got to four, although issue three was issue two of Barbaric Adventures or something
Oh, was it?
stupid. Yeah, it was a
Okay.
real kind of, they were all over the place, these comics. So let's talk about Atlas Comics themselves then, and how they came into being. So I think the initial announcements that something big was happening was not in the UK. I'm talking about in the US and across the comic press in the US was about 74, in 74 when the news started to break up, a new house of ideas, as they
Oh yes, of
stole.
course. Yeah, that was in the advert, the full copy
It
trade
was
advert,
the
the new
new house of ideas. So let's talk about that then. So it was Martin Goodman
advert.
and his little project. So what can you tell me about that?
Well, what I understand, I mean, if anybody who's listening is looking for more background on this, the authority is the Tomorrow's Publishing Comic Book Artist number 16, if you can find it. If not, you can buy a PDF on their site, actually, to give them a
I
plug.
think is this the one that is this the one?
Got the Grim Ghost on the cover. That's it. That's it. Yeah, I lent mine to a mutual friend, never got it back.
Do you know what? I've got a sneaky feeling I got this off Stephen Hunt.
Well, that's mine. You
And
get.
so this is your copy. It's a small world, but we wouldn't want to paint it.
Yeah, the small
I know
we've got to live
it may well have come from him.
okay.
So I'll
Well,
have to return
I'm
it to
glad it
you.
ended up with you, Darren. You know, that's fine. It can stay where it is. But yeah, so
Fantastic.
Marnie Goodman was the publisher of Marvel. Marvel's predecessor, of course, was called Atlas Comics.
It was.
And now I think the chronology goes something like Goodman sold out in about 68, 69 to Cadence Industries, but remained as publisher till about 72. Now, there's two versions of this story that from different people. He started Atlas as a money-making venture, or he started Atlas to get revenge on Cadence because on a handshake they'd promised to make his son Charles Goodman publisher and editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics, and that never happened, and it was never contractual. Gary Friedrich, the writer, says Goodman wouldn't do anything unless it was for money, but John Romita, who was art director at Marvel, said it was definitely a revenge project. So, I mean, make of that what you will.
I mean, they even got the nickname Vengeance Incorporated, didn't they? Which was
That's right. Yeah, that's
the
right.
nickname that other artists and publishers gave to the company. So whichever version we believe. So 74, they started talking formally about the launch of Atlas Comics being imminent. I think initially they said they were going to start with six titles,
Right.
but that very quickly spiraled into a sudden big launch of about, was it 20 odd titles all at once
Well, not
in
only that, but
35?
it was a launch of a whole range. It was trying to mirror Marvel in every respect in terms of color comics, black and white magazines, even a gothic romance title, which were popular at the time. I mean, it's fascinating that it's all based. I mean, the more interesting story is obviously if it was really a revenge project based around Martin Goodman's son. Maybe we should mention the literary story that was written about him.
About Chip, I think his
Yeah,
nickname
about
was,
Chip,
wasn't it?
Charles
About
Goodman, Chip
Chip,
Goodman, yeah, allegedly. So
So
that
this
was,
was it. This was in that Playboy issue.
Playboy, according to my research, February 1970, Playboy. There's a story called, I think, something like The Publisher's Son. I've not read it, I've never seen it, but allegedly that is a key.
I actually got hold of the PDF.
Oh,
Of that
okay.
issue, and it's the publisher's son, and it is it's so obviously
Believe you. I'll believe you. But it's just another interesting sideline to the whole saga, I think.
because the other thing as well is this whole thing about it being Vengeance Incorporated. By all accounts, Martin Goodman didn't have a lot of respect for his son either.
That's interesting. Wow.
He would
Okay.
often berate him and tear him down in front of the other staffers
Wow.
at quite a lot of times. And I think an interesting anecdote is let's talk about the content of the publisher's son, and then we'll give the anecdote. So the content of the publisher's son, which is a fictitious story about a publisher's son who has more interest in being involved in skin magazines than
Okay,
anything
not
else.
politics. Yeah.
And it wasn't very flattering to the son, and it actually exposed a lot about the relationship between Martin and Chip,
Yeah.
and how it was almost like there was a real sense of disdain from Martin Goodman aimed at his son, whereas Chip felt that he was the one that was trying to do everything right, but obviously always getting it wrong,
Yeah,
kind
yeah.
of thing. So it's a fascinating little excursion into the minds of these people. But what's really interesting is the guy that wrote it worked for Martin Goodman.
Oh, interesting. Not that I didn't know.
He worked for Martin Goodman, and He'd gone on holiday when Playboy picked it up and decided to print it. So he found out on holiday that his story criticizing his boss and the boss's son had been published, and he got back from holiday expecting to be fired. And instead, apparently, the story goes, Martin Goodman actually promoted him to editor because he was impressed that one of his staffers had got a story in Playboy. That's just
Well, that's interesting.
that's just
I suppose we should point out that, as far as we know, the story is wholly fictional, as far as we're aware.
yes,
So.
and neither Chip nor Martin are around to defend themselves, but these are the kind of myths and legends that have grown up around this whole venture with Atlas Comics. So they launched, as we said, in 75, this first range of colour comics, and then they added the black and white magazines. And as you said a moment ago about the fact that they were trying to copy everything that Marvel were doing. And so maybe we could go into a little bit more detail about that, because, I mean, for example, it wasn't just Marvel, it was DC, because one of the characters, I think it was Sergeant Hawk in the eventual comic that was released, was originally going to be called Sergeant Stone.
Sergeant Stone, yeah, I can't imagine what they were trying to replicate.
It was a war comic about a gruff sergeant who was in,
Really? Wow.
who cared more about his company, the soldiers in his team, than following orders from the people on high. So it's quite amusing. So, I mean, there was a correlation. I mean, we had barbarian stories, we
Conan
had,
was popular, Sword and Sorcery was popular.
so we had Wolf and Iron Jaw. We had obviously Spider-Man was huge, and we had the Scorpion's transition, not the original Scorpion, but the transition in issue 3 was very much suddenly he was Spider-Man with a different name.
And it was rubbish.
It was, I mean, compared to the two issues that had been before, it was just, what is going on?
Such a downturn.
Yeah, and then we had the police action comics, we had the anthology horror ones, and
The
then the
Brute,
black,
I guess, was a Hulk correlation. Morlock, was it Morlock 2001? Swamp Thing, the Man Thing. And then there were a couple of curious ones. I mean, I looked at this last night. Tiger Man was curious. It wasn't really spy. It wasn't really anything. More like Wolverine to me when you look back at it. And
Before
that had,
Wolverine,
yeah,
yeah.
before Wolverine. And then that had like almost in the one of the black and white magazines, they had a slightly more adult version of it, but in black and white. Very strange comic. And then Destructor was almost its own thing, a hybrid of organized crime and superheroes
And the
that wasn't
anti-hero.
really, it wasn't really Spider-Man. It wasn't really the Punisher. If the Punisher was around by then, I guess he was. But that was a curious title. Rereading that, I mean, there was a clear line of story by Archie Goodwin. I mean, it's such a great line of battalion on that title. There's a clear storyline being developed, and then it just takes a total left turn with issue four.
Like they all did.
Yes, as they all did,
So let's get into that then. So maybe we should actually, you just alluded to, he had a great lineup of talent, and maybe we should just d name drop some of the names that were there. So there was Steve Ditko, Archie Goodwin,
Hollywood,
Ollie Wood.
Archie
There was,
Goodwin.
just who else was there? There was Rich Buckler,
Frank Thorne, Neil Adams
Frank.
doing covers.
Yeah, it had some
Harry
really,
Chapin, writer artist.
and it attracted these people by doing some things that actually changed the comic industry going forward in a big way. So they paid them more for a start off. They gave them, and this was unheard of at the time, but they gave them joint ownership rights to the characters they created, which is complete. I mean, you only have to look at the whole sorry Superman saga with DC Comics with Simon and Schuster. It was unheard of, and they gave the art back to the artists,
I
which
understand
again,
that. I understand that all some of those promises weren't honored 100% of the time, but I mean, the intention was there, certainly. And I think they were geographically located across the road from Marvel Comics, literally across. So I guess if you got hacked off and you had an argument, you went and waited.
Yes.
at the crosswalk, crossed over, and you know, went to work for them. So yeah, it was an
Yeah.
interesting situation. But I guess the ramifications of all that wouldn't be felt for a few years, I think, what they did.
No, and I think it did force DC and Marvel to change some of their policies, but this is where the dirty tricks then started, because DC did up the rate to the artists and writers, and they did say that they would start to return artwork, but it was only for artists and writers who were already at DC and who would commit to exclusively only doing work for DC. Marvel did something similar in terms of if you went to work at Atlas, you couldn't do any work with Marvel,
Yeah, I read that, yeah.
whether you were freelance or not. And then the Marvel at the time had a particularly great deal going on with the distributors of comics, and they offered distributors a higher discount. This is the route. This is from what I've read. And I haven't read anything that said it's not. I'll just put that disclaimer in there, but I also can't really confirm this because we weren't around in the industry at the time. But apparently, they offered the distributors a higher rate of discount if they didn't s distribute Atlas Comics.
I didn't know that. I didn't know. The other thing which occurred to me doing some research was the other thing Atlas tried to replicate was the merchandise company that Warren had,
Yeah.
but in the color comics, which I thought was interesting. You know,
Yeah.
Warren used to sell all that merchandise from the back of the mags, you know, if you ever saw a Warren magazine then, which wasn't very often. And then Atlas tried to do the same thing. They had adverts for model kits, books, 8mm reels, monster masks, et cetera.
Yeah.
And that's something, as far as I'm aware, Marvel and DC, I don't think they ever attempted that.
I can't remember. I'm thinking back. You know, I think you might be right. I don't think they had
Not a direct,
merchandise
you know, not a
lines like
company,
that.
but yeah, merchandise and directly merchandised it from the titles.
Yeah. I hadn't considered that. The way that they, I mean, if you look at that, Atlas went big in many ways, and they had a lot of great ideas. It was the implementation, I
Well,
think,
I
of the
mean,
ideas.
should we mention the two editors who were employed?
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I
So,
think is great. I mean, both big in the industry at the time. Jeff Rovin came from Warren, and
yeah.
Larry Lieber, who is Stan Lee's brother.
Who apparently used to introduce himself as, I'm Larry Lieber, Stan Lee's brother, at every
Really?
opportunity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I guess you would. You know, I mean, why shouldn't he? But so Jeff went from a black and white line of magazines as from being an editor. And Larry Lieber went from a color line of comics of being an editor, and Goodman reversed them and put Larry in charge of the black and white magazines and
Yeah.
Jeff in charge of the color comics, which, you know, must have added to the chaos.
Oh, it just, I mean, it does. I mean, I think whenever anyone does a post on Facebook in some of the comic groups, I mean, yes, I'm that much of a nerd, they do a post about Atlas Comics. I always say Atlas Comics, mad, bad, and dangerous to know, but
Yeah,
great fun. Just, and
absolutely.
I think that sums it up, because it was just utter chaos I think from more or less start to finish, if you read some of the horror stories. About
Yeah,
editorial
also, I mean,
meetings.
I don't quite what the logistics of this is, but I think it took several months for sales figures to get back to the actual publishers.
Yeah.
And you've got to think that they changed course, changed direction before they even had any sales figures back, but from what you said before, if the other publishers were trying to block their distribution, then,
Yeah.
you know, maybe it got a little serious before that time. So I've no idea about how well they sold or how poorly they sold.
I think the figure that I found was they sold 13%. So 13%. And what was really ironic is I remember, because back in the days when comics used to have letters pages, which was always, to me, the letters pages were part of the fun of the title you were reading.
Definitely.
There were letter after letter, in title after title, that was complaining about your dispute. I can't get hold of your issues. I got issue one, but I couldn't get issue two. And it was that kind of, almost every issue, there was at least two letters about couldn't get hold of an issue. And yet in the UK, over a period of about 6 months, I was going down to this local newsagent in Darton and picking up, five or six titles every month from there. So we had easier distribution here than it sounded like they had in the States. I mean, I know we were a few months behind anyway. I think was it the summer of 75 they launched in America? I think it was the autumn before we got the first issues
I think
here.
so, yeah, it would have been. I distinctly remember it being, well, it wasn't the summer. I still remember being at school, so I think that would be the case. But I mean, that's interesting if people literally couldn't get hold of them. I know I like you, I bought the Scorpion, I bought number two, and then soullessly hunted down number one because I had to have it. And I actually found it in a news agent's at the top of London Road in Liverpool. I remember that. And it was like, like coming across, I don't know, the Holy Grail or something.
It
But
was. It was. This, if you've never read The Scorpion, guys and girls, you do need to look at Scorpion One.
great title. It's a great title. It's that great Chaykin where he sets the mood and the atmosphere and the characters almost instantly. And as I've always said to you, the best thing about Chaykin at the time, looking back, it was clear that all these characters had a sex life. Most characters you really didn't, you had no idea, I think. But wonderful title, and it did have a life going forward, which was great.
I mean, it went, so we looked at that and the whole, and it's a shame because a lot of the titles, despite being derivative, despite the constant chopping and changing, almost, I mean, the Phoenix changed almost from issue to issue in terms of the direction it was going. They captured this element of fun, and I think they're not, I don't, apart from maybe half a dozen of the issues of the titles, none of them were ever likely to win any kind of award. Scorpion won. The Scorpion, if it had been able to continue in its vein, probably would have done, to be fair. But for all that, for all the bad writing, for all some of the issues had bad art as well, for all that, they were great fun to read.
Yeah, they were. Yeah, and some of them owed nothing to anything really. I mean, Grim Ghost was just this totally unique title.
With
With
Ernie
great
Coleman
art,
doing the art.
doing the art. Yeah, it's a great title. I mean, the Cougar was their version of Kolchak the Night Stalker.
Yes, I
And
heard that.
the Cougar, there's a title you couldn't apply to a male superhero these days.
No. It's interesting. Our times have definitely changed the meaning of quite a few
Correct.
different phrases and words.
It's been appropriated elsewhere.
But there was just this energy about them, and
Yeah,
maybe,
absolutely.
and maybe that chaotic editorial room did in fact inject that energy into the titles, even though that energy wasn't focused. It seemed to go all over the place. But certainly for a 10, 11-year-old reading those titles, it was like, wow, this is amazing. And it was, I mean, it must have been because once we got the first few titles, I kept going back to that newsagent week after week after week, trying to see what else I
Likewise,
could.
yeah,
I hadn't
definitely.
had that. I mean, yes, I was getting my Marvel UK weeklies, but that was, I didn't have that same, I loved my Marvel UK weeklies, but I didn't have that same anticipation of, I wonder if they've got any new titles in this week.
Correct, and what you were going to find. You didn't know what. One thing I've never been able to establish is, did in terms of the titles, did they solicit the titles, or did they just rely on creators going in and taking the sort of finish, or taking the ideas or the finished product into them? I'm never sure.
I think, I don't know. I mean, I couldn't find out for sure exactly how the UK or when the UK started distributing the Atlas comics. I've just got a feeling one of the, like the Alan Cass reprints, and he got all these kind of deals sorted out. And I think he, part of the, his ability to do that was because he could get things shipped in quite cheap. I think they used a network similar to that to bring in American comics, kind of differently from the way that the UK comics were distributed across newsagents, and we didn't have specialist comic shops really back then, did we? Thinking about it,
Well, certainly I never saw one, I never saw
no,
one at that point in time. But I mean they all turned up with the TMP, the Thorpe and Porter stamp, didn't they, on the
yes,
cover?
they did.
I
So that
guess
was
they must
a,
have been coming through the same route as DC and certainly DC, which used to have the same thing.
yeah.
Marvels did have a price on them, the ones that we saw, didn't they? Had a little sort of pence price in the
Pence
corner.
price, whereas the The DCs that I saw, and certainly the Atlas comics that I got, had that, as you say, a stamp saying 5p or 4p or whatever it was. 5p for a comic, if only.
Bargain.
So they did that. So we had all the color range, and then they also launched the magazine range, the black and white comics, and a movie magazine, which were aimed at a more mature market. And yet, I think ratings were a bit more lax in the UK than they were in the America. And I think also part of it was a comic magazine, and therefore it must be for kids. So even at 11, I picked up Devilina
Never saw that
and
one where I lived. I never saw that one. Saw Thrilling Adventure Tales, but never saw
yeah.
Devilene.
Well, I got Thrilling and I got the two Devilina issues, and I'd only be 11 years old. And you can imagine this 11-year-old gets home, opens the it's like, oh,
To be honest, I've
nudity.
known you for a while, Darren. That explained a lot.
It does, doesn't it, really? I won't say I was scarred from the experience. It was just an eye-opener in many ways. I think that set me on a trajectory down this obsession with certain comics. Anyway, that's by the by. So we've got all that going, and again, they had the horror anthology with Devilina, which was trying to copy the kind of
Certainly, the Warren
Warren
issue,
side of things.
Vampirella springs to mind as an obvious, it's an
Yeah,
obvious.
absolutely. And then they had the Thrilling Adventure, which was kind of a look at Marvel had just started to go into the black and white range with
Sort of
Deadly
Savage
Hands of
Tales,
Kung Fu and
Savage
Savage Tales. Savage Tales.
Tales, I guess. I mean, there was different genres in that, wasn't there? Sort of straight
It
adventure. There was a
was.
Lawrence of Arabia strip, Frank Thorne. There was
Yeah.
a weird Tiger Man, slightly more adult version, Ernie Colon again. And
Yeah, the
then sort
story that. Go on.
Cro-Mag the Killer, sort of Khazar type.
Oh, yeah, I've forgotten about
I think I recall that one. I never got the second issue, so I've no idea what happened in issue two. I remember the first one vividly. I
yeah, I
always like
got
the
both.
photo feature on the Ron
Yes.
Ealy film. I do
Yes.
recall that. I do recall that.
Yeah. So they had, as we said, they had great ideas. And they had a really good lineup of artists and writers, and they had some really interesting titles and fun titles. But for all that, they couldn't undo the chaos in the editorial side. And I think the biggest problem that they had was definitely the lack of distribution.
So,
And
I
I think.
mean, do we know what initiated that kind of left or right turn? It was the reboot
Mark,
of Doom, the issue three reboot of Doom.
I know. Well, it was basically Martin Goodman, apparently, we used to go in and demand changes right from the start. Whereas Chip, who was supposed to be in charge, would just breeze in and say, what we're doing this week, oh, that looks all right, and then breeze back out trying to pick up models, allegedly. And just thought we'd say that. And, but he apparently he would go in and he would demand changes to the color, to the covers. He would demand changes in the scripts, and we don't know why. As you say, it took several months for figures to come through. So was he reacting on feedback he was getting from people in the industry, or did he just really not have a clear idea of where he wanted to take the line once it was out there? Or was it just literally was interfering in the direction or the lack of direction set by his son and throwing his weight around? We don't know because we can't ask the man, unfortunately.
And I don't think I say. You read through what's online and the text of comic book artists. I'm not sure it really gives the whole story as to that, but I mean, it's a
Yeah.
strange, strange thing. What should we talk about, though? I mean, at least a couple of the characters had a bit of a life afterwards.
They did. So over to you, Maestro.
Well, okay, so as far as I could see, there's two. There's a lesser one. Well, maybe not a lesser one, but Demon Hunter, which is a great title by I think Dave Kraft and Rich Buckler, one
Oh,
issue.
that was my I think that was my favorite issue till I got older, Scorpion
I
One.
think that was pretty much the last title of theirs I ever saw, actually. It
Yeah.
was pretty much the last one I ever saw. But it really, that really captured me at the time. And I thought, well, what a shame. And then obviously he then appeared as Devil Slayer. in the Defenders when Dave Craft was doing the Defenders.
Yeah, and with a costume that only had a slightly different color
Correct, yeah. It was
of blue.
clearly the same guy. Well, not
Yeah.
maybe the same guy, it was clearly the same character. So that was, that was good. But seemed very odd at the time. It seemed quite unsettling to see a character from another company turn up in your Marvel comics.
Yes.
But I guess, that's part of the impact of the company. And then the greater one, of course, would be, Chaykin's great, the Scorpion. I'm sure you can tell by now I love the Scorpion.
Oh, it was just mind-blowing, wasn't
It was great. It
it?
was great. I must say, he was just a master of what he does. He still is. And that turned up. I remember buying an issue, black and white Marvel called Marvel Super Action, and it's got the Punisher on the cover.
Yeah.
Great painting of him. And turning inside, and there's a black and white story by Chaykin, which I always look forward to, and that beautifully done in like greys and washes.
Yes.
And I thought, hold on, this is the Scorpion. I mean, his costume's a little bit different, but this is definitely the Scorpion. But he'd kind of flipped him and gone from really
Yes.
serious pulp to sticking him in Hollywood,
Yeah.
with all the dark side of Hollywood and crime and narcissism and gambling, etc.,
Yeah.
etc. So we had to use the black and white format, which didn't have a rating system. And I mean, that's gone on sporadically. That went from there. He had an issue of Marvel Spotlight with Terry
Yeah.
Austin. Did with Nick
Yeah.
Fury, not Nick Fury, sorry, Dum Dum Dugan, I think, was the guest star, set in just before World War II. And then he did some stories with Denny O'Neill in Rampaging Hulk magazine, which was, I think, was some of the first full process color
Yeah.
comics ever. And then obviously a few years ago, he had a Max Marvel Max series, which was just great fun about him escorting four thinly disguised Hollywood celebrities on a
Yes.
tour, which, as with Chaykin, exploits the adult rating to the full. And he's great fun. And he's great fun.
Yeah.
Hopefully we'll see more of him in the future. I remember speaking to, as I said, I spoke to Howard in Miami at a convention, and he said he
Yeah.
had tons more ideas for Dominic Fortune, particularly a Spanish Civil War story. I'd love to see that one.
That would be great.
That would be
That
great, yeah.
would be great.
So, I mean, that's part of the impact going forward, I suppose, that some of those characters have survived. And I think, you and I have talked about Atlas. You think about what happened in the early to mid 80s in terms of independent comic companies. Atlas was about 6, 7 years too early.
Yeah.
But what?
I think Rovan actually did an article where he said how not to launch a comic book company.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
Yeah. Shortly before, I think all the independents suddenly started to explode
Yeah.
on the scene. So he said the biggest legacy that Atlas Comics had was the template of how not to do it.
Exactly. Yeah, that's it. It's like they blazed the trail. I mean, they
Yeah.
had to fail, so maybe those independent companies could be, successful to a degree. I mean, a lot of them aren't around anymore because the market's
Yeah.
changed. But yeah, Atlas did it first. We showed you how not to do it, guys.
Yeah. But as we
Let's
mentioned, some of the changes they made, some of the contractual changes they made were then picked up and brought into the industry going forward to lesser or greater degrees. And then, of course, when the independents came along and changed an image later, changed it all again and gave much more creator rights than had ever been seen before. But I still think Atlas blazed the trail on that. And showed that things, it actually gave writers and artists a kind of gift of this is how it could be done
I
and it
guess,
should be done.
I mean, we already know, I think, in comics history that people like Neil Adams was campaigning for creators' rights, even before Atlas was set up. But yeah, I mean, that gave, it set the stage, and it gave the independent companies like Pacific and Eclipse. I guess they knew what they had to offer these creators to get them to come and work for them.
Yeah, definitely. So that's Atlas in the past, and we keep mentioning the word whenever we speak about Atlas, we keep mentioning the word chaos, and it seems to be a common thread going throughout their entire history because there was an abortive attempt to relaunch them. Was it 2010?
2010, 2011, I went to Mark Miller's Kapow convention in London,
Yeah.
and it was either Charles Goodman or maybe his son was there with Arden Entertainment, and they had a stand, and they were relaunching some of the titles. They weren't reprinting them.
Yeah.
I think there was an Ashcan issue, I think Grim Ghost. I mean,
Yeah.
I remember I flicked through them to be honest, I wasn't that impressed with what I saw. And I remember asking and getting a fairly terse response, well, are you going to reprint the original stuff then?
Yeah.
And they weren't particularly, well, they didn't want to answer my question. They didn't want to answer my question. They obviously clearly wanted to push the new titles. And I think that came and went pretty quickly.
Yeah, because of the chaos. Because what happened was they were going to relaunch under Atlas, but I can't remember the guy's name now. I was going to say Paul Stephen or Stephen Paul, but someone owned the Atlas brand, and then he sold that to Dynamite Entertainment.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
But here's where it gets crazy. So they bought what they thought was the Atlas brand and everything.
And back catalogue, presumably.
But they only actually got the rights to the logo and the brand.
Oh, okay.
Not the IP. None of the titles, none of the characters. And so is it Jason Goodman, who's Chip's son?
He's Chip's son, yeah.
Yeah, and Stephen Paul, who's in the mix now. They have decided they want to relaunch the comics now to tie in with the 50-year anniversary. And they've also apparently done a deal with Paramount Plus about some... I think they're going to be streaming movies. I don't think they'll be released to the big screen. To do... I think Devilina's scheduled for 2026, for example. But they can't use the Atlas name on its own. So they're having to relaunch, because Dynamite Entertainment still own that. So they're having to do the branding as Atlas Comics / Seaboard Entertainment.
Oh, of course, yeah, because they were Seaboard. Were they Seaboard Periodicals? Was that their trade?
Yeah. So they still have that, but they can't just go as Atlas Comics. So it has to be Atlas / Seaboard, which I'm not sure how that's going to work as a logo. And so it's just a thread of chaos
that runs through this whole saga, which is great in a way. Yeah. It makes it more interesting, frankly. Yeah. So presumably all those creators who got equity in the titles, like Chaykin and Rich Buckler and X, they can't use them.
By the sounds of it, because the original contracts were for joint ownership. So Seaboard have joint ownership. And the creators have some ownership rights. So I'm assuming that if, let's say, they did do The Scorpion, but without Howard Chaykin would still get some kind of royalty. I don't know if there's a kind of timeout that goes on in comic ownership where, you know, after so many decades, can't.
Who knows? I mean, but again, it's just that it's that thread of chaos stitching.
It's that who knows what's happening kind of. I mean, I was looking into this. I was like, what? Who? And I looked into that and it was like, no, he can't do that because, I mean, Dynamite Entertainment in 2010, a bit later than 2010, they made quite a strong statement when the stories came out that Jason Goodman and Stephen Paul were trying to pull together, saying, we don't know why they're going around talking about Atlas Comics because we own the rights. Okay. And they made a very black and white statement went out to the press. But it turned out they only owned the rights to the brand, not the characters. So it's a real mess again. It's all over the place. But it's going to be interesting to see what actually comes out in 2026, because the comics are going to be, from what I can gather, the comics are going to be exclusively distributed through Walmart in the States.
Okay.
And this might all be completely wrong and it might change by this time next week. Who knows with Atlas, because that seems to be the theme going forward. And the... I'm assuming made for streaming movies are going to go through Paramount Plus. So
interesting. Do you know what the best movie would be? The best movie would be, I don't know if you've seen the Saturday Night Live movie about the launch of Saturday Night Live, the Jason Reitman movie, worth seeing, really worth seeing. Right. The best movie would be a movie about Atlas Comics, about the formation and the running and the collapse and the chaos of Atlas Comics.
And the behind the scenes chaos.
Yeah, that'd probably be more entertaining than any superheroics they could come up with. But, I mean, interestingly as well, as you say, distributed in the US through Walmart, whenever I've been in the US in a comic book shop, there's loads of them, and nobody really seems to care.
Yeah.
They don't they command less than they do over here in terms of back issue, and they seem to be everywhere. I picked some up when I was in Canada recently, so that's interesting. The fact, as you say, I mean, who's going to know what they are in Walmart?
I know.
I can't imagine. You know,
it's just, again, why would you do that? Why wouldn't you actually be working and getting a distribution deal into the outlets? I know that there's fewer and fewer specialist outlets in now, because comic stores tend to be more like merchandise stores these days. And maybe that's the plan. Maybe the comics are really the loss leader to get the merchandise, because they've already done a range of toys. You told me this the other day.
I think I saw some news items said they were they doing two Mego figures with a reprint of the first issue? Was it Phoenix and Grim Ghost?
I think the Cougar's there as well.
The Cougar?
Actually,
really?
Yeah.
Yeah. For?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that'll just confuse people.
Yeah. What am I buying?
What's this? You know, interesting. That's interesting. I mean, good luck to them. I hope they succeed. I really do. I'd love to see some of the original stuff reprinted, you know, some nice reprints. I mean, goodness knows where the material is now and who owns the original art, etc. So I guess you would get the best copies they could from the, you know, printed comics, which would be a shame. But I mean, who'd have thought you'd have seen Mego figures? You see, if they'd had those at the time, they could have sold them through their own merchandising company.
Yeah, and made some money.
Yeah, yeah. And as you say, it's that thread of total chaos that runs through this whole saga.
Yeah, it's kind of like, again, so they're going for a joint launch of a new comic line, the toys, which are already out as the first leg, I guess, to remind people, I guess, about Atlas Comics. And then you've got the movie deals with Paramount Plus, and they're going for that big bang approach again. And it's almost
the same,
replicating
the whole thing again. You know, we're going to cover every base from day one.
Instead of, let's do two or three titles, get them properly put together, let's get 12 issues in the bank before we actually launch, and let's just go for it. And then, because that was the other thing as well, I mean, sometimes one of the biggest causes, sometimes they went 3 months between a title anyway, because they didn't have it ready to go. So there's that to factor in. And, you know, all people, if you're trying to keep the interest of young comic book writers, readers, they need to know, if they go to their comic shop on that same Saturday every month, that the title's going to be there. Because if it's not there and they're expecting it, they quickly move on. And it's almost, I just think they haven't learned some of the lessons.
No. I mean, this is one for you, Darren, really, given your expertise. I mean, we both made our way through the corporate world, you know, through life. Yeah. But there's clearly never been the post-collapse meeting with title Lessons Learned.
No.
I mean, you should offer your services, Darren. You should offer your services.
Maybe you and I should go in as consultants and just say, look, guys,
Lessons Learned seminar, Let's look at what happened previously.
Yeah. And they're also launching at a time when interest in superhero movies has now, I think this cycle has more or less petered out. It'll come back.
It'll come back eventually when they start making more interesting material. Yeah. So who knows? I mean, to make something as individualistic. I mean, I was watching a news item this morning on that Netflix, is it K-pop Demon Hunters?
Yeah.
Huge success. But it's kind of, go make something original, guys.
Yeah. Well, look at Squid Game.
Don't see people haven't seen, and see how it does. So who knows? I'd love to see them come back. I'd love to see them succeed.
Yeah.
I probably won't be buying the Mego figures, I'll be honest.
No, they don't look particularly attractive either from the pictures that I've seen.
Well, I mean, from your point of view, Darren, they haven't got to the Devilina action figure. Yeah.
They have. The Devilina one is awful. It's not, no. It looks almost like block Lego to me.
Okay.
It's not, it's like, you know, Devilina is supposed to be this live, demonic seductress, and she just looks like a man in drag, to be honest.
All right. Alongside the action figure of the male cougar.
Yeah.
The mind boggles.
Yeah. People of a certain age are just not going to understand what's going on, are they?
No, unfortunately not. Yeah, but let's. I really hope they succeed. I mean, I'd love to see some of those characters. I mean, some of those characters had real potential. Destructor could have been great. Destructor really could have been great. Scorpion was great. You're more of a fan of the other titles. Grim Ghost was pretty interesting.
Yeah, I like that. I really like the son of where they went with the Son of Dracula
Yeah.
title as well. The concept behind that was fascinating, and I think if it had been allowed to breathe, it would have rivaled Marvel's horror titles at the time. I'm sure, because
And they had some
it was
good
a
talent, you know.
different take.
Yeah, and Frank Thorne, I think, on art. And was that was before he started dressing up as some of his characters.
With his models.
With his mind, you can't blame him.
No.
Rest in peace, Frank. Fantastic
Yeah.
talent.
Yeah.
Fantastic talent.
So, but before we bring this to an end, then, are there any other comments, questions, anecdotes
I
that
don't
you'd like
think
to put
so.
forward?
I mean, ultimately, people have written huge tomes, haven't they, about the history of Marvel and DC? And they've been around a long time. But, possibly the most interesting story is Atlas Comics. And that's why I say, wouldn't it, a movie about Atlas Comics would probably be as entertaining as a movie about any of the characters. And I thought that I was on a plane. I watched that Saturday Night Live movie, the Jason Reitman one, which I would recommend to anyone. I'm sure there's a, you and I have managed to talk about it for quite a while. I'm sure you could make 90 minutes out of it. It would be very entertaining and probably very amusing.
Yes, I think it would be. I think it'd be absolutely brilliant. You could have Jim Carrey as Martin Goodman, and
The casting options are endless, I think. Endless.
yeah. Not sure who you'd cast as Chip, but I definitely see, because he's about the right age now, Jim Carrey, isn't he, to be playing Martin at that time?
Yeah, I guess he's a bit older than us, isn't he? So he's probably mid-60s or something like that. But
That'd be interesting.
no, I mean that'll be good. And I don't know. It's just such an interesting anecdote in comic book history, which is obviously largely focused on the big two in many ways. But it as you say, apart from all the chaos, it was I guess something that had to happen, so we would eventually arrive with the independence that revolutionized things in the early to mid-80s.
And the greater recognition of creators. And I
Yeah,
think
it must have
that.
been. I mean, you and I probably can't appreciate that because, we're not creators in that sense. But I guess the impact of that amongst the people who were around at the time trying to make a living out of the industry must have been huge. I mean, to force somebody like Warner Brothers to put their page rates up must have been the creators couldn't do it apparently on their own. So.
No. I think if we're looking at that, if we want a legacy from Atlas, apart from the template of how not to launch a comic book
Yeah,
company,
that's the
I
title of the
think,
movie, by the way. That's the title of the
yeah, it
film.
has to be, doesn't it? Absolutely. I think that's the key impact for me is that it did lead to a greater recognition of creators in the comic book industry, because up to that point, let's be honest, they weren't particularly treated with the respect that they should have had.
No. I mean, certainly not. No, from what we know. So, I mean, like you say, if you go back to the Superman creators, I mean, what a disgrace. I mean, for me, the legacy, I mean, it is all that legacy. In a way, I don't care. It gave us Dominic Fortune. It gave us the Scorpion and then Dominic Fortune. So I'm quite happy. And I've met Howard Chaykin, and he's more than happy to talk about Dominic Fortune. He really is. So that's it, one of its legacy for me. But yeah, let's hope we see them come back in some form or other.
I mean, for listeners, I am going to put up images of the covers and the artwork in the post that goes up with this episode, so they can see some of the visuals. And to be honest, a lot of the covers had a very modern appeal about them. They weren't some of the, I mean, some of them have dated a little, but when you look at the Scorpion cover, the Demon Hunter cover, that could be on any comic today. And it would look right. It wouldn't look of its time like a lot of the other old DC and old Marvel ones do. And so we'll do that. And then I think at some point you're going to come back and we're going to talk about our adventures in comics in general and just, have a lot of fun teasing out our favorite titles and why. And
We should talk about our experiences at comic conventions, really. That would be equally as entertaining.
yes. Yeah, we've got a lot to go at in adventure. I think there's some this is going to be like a mini series that runs underneath the podcast, and it will be under the Adventures in Comics banner, I think, because there is a lot to go at.
Let's do it. No, let's do it. Mini series. You see, you're back to comics already, Darren.
I know, it's great, isn't it? So I think all it remains for me to say is to say thanks, Chris.
No, thank
I've
you.
really enjoyed that. That was great fun.
No, thanks for the opportunity. You and I never, when we spent time together at Comic Avenger in the pub afterwards, we never had trouble talking about this stuff.
We
So
didn't.
things
And thanks to
change.
the, yeah, absolutely. And thanks to the listener for putting up with us. And we'll see you again soon.
Yeah, take care, buddy.
We hope you enjoyed that. We're going to put pictures of all the comics we spoke about into the forum post that goes with this episode. So if you go to darreninform.com/thinkworksforum, there'll be a post for this episode, and we'll put artwork and covers up in the post there for you to comment on. Come and share your memories of Atlas Comics, when you first discovered them, what you thought. Did you buy them back in the day like Chris and I did 50 years ago? Oh my goodness, we're giving our age away. But, and what do you remember? What was your favorite title? Why do you think they failed? Really, ultimately, do you disagree with the analysis that Chris and I have given? Come and ask your questions. Next week, we'll return to a normal kind of subject, something a little less nerdy or geeky like the last couple of episodes have been. But I hope you enjoyed these. We're going to do another Adventures in Comics soon, where we'll look at just comics in general and talk about our memories of the industry back when it had significance. So take care, everyone. Keep asking questions, and I'll see you all soon. All that remains for me to say is bye for now.
Would like to find out more, or join in with the conversation, our forum has a corresponding post for you to comment in. Simply go to darreninform.com/thinkworksforum and join in the fun. Or you can join the Facebook page by searching for @DarrenInform for news, tips and other helpful strategies. The show was hosted by Darren Smithson, and the music is by Alexander Nakarada. You have been listening to ThinkWorks, the podcast for thinkers.